Hey, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Wonder Podcast, the podcast where we break down and review films and sometimes TV shows all in one big, long, unbroken take. I'm Austin Archer, and with me, as always, is my childhood next door neighbor and lifelong best friend,
Kramer England.
And we were adolescents together. We were adolescent young men, and we went through adolescence together.
Yes. Luckily, we didn't murder anyone.
That you know of.
Yes.
That either one of us is aware of. You know, so we're still in the realm of TV. Last week, we talked about Andor season one, and we've been getting a lot of comments asking us to talk about adolescence from Netflix. Because our show is called The Wonder. And the big thing about this show is it's four episodes that are about an hour long apiece, and they're all true, unbroken Wonders. There's a lot of sort of debate. I think we're a little bit late to this. This was kind of something people were talking about maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, but I don't think, you know, I think that it's still relevant. But a lot of the talk about this show seems to be around there is definitely really potent subject matter from this show to be discussed, but a lot of the discussion seems to be centered around this convention of doing wonders for every episode, and does it work or not? Does it serve the story, or is it just a gimmick? Because that's kind of the question anytime this convention is used, is like, sure, it's technically impressive and it's interesting to look at and it's interesting to think about how they executed that, is there a reason for it to exist in this story? Just on the outside, on the surface, because obviously, just like with Andor, we're not going to be able to get through every single story beat of the show, but how did you feel about this convention, the technical convention of every episode being a wonder?
I think wonders are great. They're always fun to see because of the skill that has to go into them, right? And if you don't know it's coming, it's kind of fun sometimes to be like, oh, that it hasn't cut yet, to see those things. This is a, you know, it's funny, we've been talking, so we've done Presence, we've done Here, which both of those are kind of one takes. There are many sections that have one take. You know, it's many wonders together. And we both felt like Here wasn't really, it didn't really execute very well on that, but Presence did really, really well. And this is also another instance where it's kind of in that same ballpark, I feel like, because it's much more of a play. And I felt like it worked really, really well for this show. Because they're not trying to make it a murder mystery. They're not trying to make it. They're trying to get you into the emotion of what is happening in that moment for each situation. So the first episode is really like the, you know, they arrest the kid. They arrest him. And it's like his story along with the parents, like trying to just figure out what is going on.
The sort of whirlwind of waking up in the morning, your kids are getting ready to go to school, and in come the armed police. And they're saying, we're here to arrest your 13-year-old son for murder. And it's like just the whirlwind of that day of like what that first hour is like, following the police to the police station, talking to detectives and saying, hey, when can we talk to our son, and waiting for a solicitor, as they call it in the UK, a lawyer, and having the lawyer kind of break down what's going on. And we as the audience really do get to see how much can take place in the span of the first hour of this.
And I think they kind of I think they might have fudged that a little bit, because it seemed like it was really early in the morning, so nothing was really happening, so they were able to just move through it quickly. I imagine in this process it takes longer, but I think that's a jump that I was totally willing to take, because but yeah, so much does happen in that first hour. Like,
Would think that maybe it would take longer for the lawyer to get there or something that early in the, who knows?
It's kind of like everything happens so luckily at the right time, but that's that really didn't bother me, because it was able to succeed in what it was trying to do. So I was able to make that jump, but I mean, you focus really, episodes one and two are kind of the same story. They're just dealing with this murder that just took place, and kind of the aftermath of what happens. You know, they arrest him, and then in the second episode, they're questioning his friends and they're trying to make sure that they have enough to charge Jamie, is the kid who did it, the 13-year-old boy who did it. They're trying to charge him and trying to figure out what they can do. But those two are kind of together. And then 3 and 4 are months after. I think 3 is 7 months after, or 6 months or something. And then 4 is 13 months after.
3, we kind of catch up with Jamie, who's been in the system now for several months. And I'm really fascinated by the character of Jamie. I want to say really quick just about the technical, before we move into the story and character.
I just
want to say that for me, at the question of whether or not the Wunner convention is justified or works, I'm not sure in this series that it feels as necessary or connected to the specific plot as it might in say something like Presence. The reason why it's every scene is a Wunner is because the camera is the perspective of a ghost. Yes. And so we are, as that ghost moves through the house, there would be no cuts. And we can only see the story from the perspective of this presence. So it sort of necessitates the convention. In a movie like 1917, which is one of my favorite, movies that's stitched together, what I like about that film is the immediacy of this mission that our main characters are on, that it's like in the span of, and there's one time jump where one of our main characters is knocked unconscious and he wakes up in the morning and we do a little bit of a time jump.
Yeah.
But outside of that, everything feels fluid. And it's, I like the way that movie keeps us in the immediacy of the action and doesn't release us from this.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it kind of like the movie Warfare that we watched, how it's all in real time. And it sort of shows you how much can go down in just a few hours in an active war zone and how much drama can unfold and how much tension, can build. This story, I think, totally could have been shot in a more conventional way with cover and things like that.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily see anything in here that makes it have to be a Wunner, but I also don't mind the Wunner. I'm a theater actor originally. Yeah. Where I started, and that's what, I kind of cut my teeth on the stage. And what I like about Wunners as a convention, and especially in this show, is obviously it's a huge technical achievement for the camera team, especially episode two is where they flex the most muscle. That's where they're showing off everything that they can do with this convention, passing the camera out the window and then setting it onto a drone and having the drone fly up over the entire town and then come back down and be put back in the hands of a camera operator. What I like about this show in particular that really stood out to me is the performances. And whereas in a lot of films, you're going to get performances that are sort of crafted by a director and an editor in post-production, they're going to sort of craft the beats of an actor's performance. In something like this, everything is it's like the actors are moving in real time. They're responding to each other in real time.
Yeah.
And I think that it does something to me as a viewer where I lean forward and I feel like I need to pay attention.
Yeah.
And also I just like watching actors have to work in real time off of each other and respond in real time and knowing that their performance is not going to be manipulated in post by an editor who's going to put a reaction shot into a place where they didn't actually do it on the day. You know, like everything is real and it just feels a little more grounded to me. And that's probably the thing that works the most about the convention for me, technically, is that this story, like you said, it's not really a mystery. It's quite straightforward.
Yeah.
And I think that the story hits so hard emotionally because of how real it feels. And I think part of what makes it feel real is the Wunner convention.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. The thing about Wunners, like why does anybody want to use a Wunner? Mm-hmm. So my wife, I was like, okay, I got to watch Adolescence. She's like, well, what's it about? And I said, well, it's these episodes are all done in one take, and it's about kind of like a murder and a kid. And she's like, well, why did they do that? Like, why are they just trying to flex, or is it, you know, like, is there a purpose? And I was like, that's a really great question, because a lot of oners are just to flex. Yeah. But they also serve a very specific purpose. Many of them serve a very specific purpose. Sometimes they're homages. Sometimes they're just kind of, it's just a fun way to kind of like start a movie or whatever. But I feel like one of the biggest reasons you want to do a oner is that you want to build tension.
Mm-hmm.
Now, tension can be something that it can be like absolute tension of like, oh my gosh, this is so crazy. I can't, it hasn't cut. Like, what's going on? Like at the beginning of the Sandra Bullock movie. Yes, Gravity. Like, yeah, it is really creating that tension. And the best one, or the most, the one that always comes to my head is Touch of Evil, which is that you put a bomb, a guy puts a bomb in the back of a car, and the car is driving throughout the street. And it's like, oh my gosh, when is this bomb going to go off? You know, like there's, it comes up next to a big group of people, and it's like, is it going to go off then? And so like people are talking, and like, it's a way to flex, but it's a way to build that tension. And then you can have all these other moments where you can build tension between characters, and kind of like what you're talking about, right? You can show off your acting ability and kind of have that, have that tension between the characters. Like, so the second episode was the most technically, as you were talking about, like that was the biggest flex.
Yeah.
But for me, the one that I was most impressed by, out of the three was, or sorry, out of the four was episode three. Episode just like completely, I don't know, that one blew me away. Like the,
especially from this young actor who's just doing incredible work.
Yeah. And like, and I was like so surprised by how well he did.
I got to tell you, the British people are just always kicking our butts at like,
they're amazing.
I just don't know why UK people are so much more naturally adept at acting. That like,
I don't either.
And they're just stealing all the roles from us. And I mean, I was literally meeting with my friend today who's from the UK about acting in a movie that I wrote. And I just was like, why are you guys so much better at this than us?
I've asked that too. Why aren't there so many UK actors so good?
Mm-hmm.
And this kid is really showing. I mean, I was baffled by him, because I was like, this is an extremely hard thing to do. Like to make sure, you know, you've got a like on stage, you've got a stage and you're rehearsing and everything, but you've got a camera that you got to watch out for. And sometimes it's going up close, and so you can't look into the camera. Right.
And this is his first thing he's ever done.
Yeah. I was like,
yeah,
it's crazy. And then the woman who plays in that one,
she's fantastic.
I was like blown away too. Yeah. Like she gives this amazing performance.
Mm-hmm.
And like also the simplicity of them being in a room just talking.
Yeah.
But she brings him a sandwich. Right. Mm-hmm. And she like, you can tell that they've had this history. Like there was so much story that was given in episode three. That was probably my favorite episode. Now, one and two are awesome because of the technical achievement and like the tension that they're building.
And even to a certain degree, four. Like there's there's so much that has to be pulled off in four.
Yeah. Four kind of mixes all of it, right?
Yeah.
Like you have a family that has to act together, but they also have to do this choreography that is like, that's pretty amazing. And so this story could be told without having a oner.
Yeah.
The reason that I think the story works really well with four different oners is that it's not about the surface story.
Mm-hmm.
This whole, you know, these four episodes are not about what's happening.
Right.
Like the thing, it's all about the emotion of the characters,
mm-hmm.
what they're going through in the moment.
Yeah.
It's not about the whole thing. It's not about how it affects everybody. It's about how it affects these people.
Yeah, how it affects the community.
Yes.
That drone shot in episode two isn't just a flex shot.
Yeah.
It's also a shot about, because episode two is really about the community.
Yeah.
Episode two is about how it's affecting the kids at school,
yep.
how it's affecting, you know, the teachers, how it's affecting this neighborhood. And that drone shot is sort of showing kind of it's showing the community and also the tight knit aspect of this, that this is a small town.
Yes.
And then coming down in on that father,
putting
who, by the way, what a performance from this guy.
This but guy is awesome.
There are so many incredible performances
yes
in the show. I would say now I like what you said about like the reason to use a winner is to build tension. Have you been watching the show The Studio at all on Apple Plus?
No, I've heard about it. I need to.
It's a lot of fun. Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg are doing a ton of winners. The show is just like full of winners. But specifically, there's I think it's episode 2 maybe of the show.
Yeah,
it's called The Winner. And it's Seth Rogen plays this studio head who's also like a big film nerd. And he wants to go to set for a movie that they're making because the final shot of the movie is this big winner. And he wants to be there for it. He wants to like go and watch it. And the whole episode is a winner of him kind of constantly messing up their take because everyone like doesn't want the studio head there. They're like, it makes us all nervous if you're here because everyone like, you know, so like, but he's like, I promise I'll just be hanging in the background. But then he keeps messing up their shot. Like he's like whispering during one of the shots at one point. And Greta Lee, who's acting in the take, is like, I can hear whispering, you guys, we need to, you know? And then he's like, I'm so sorry. I'm so like, and then like, and it's like, it's a really frustrating episode to watch too. But as you said, to build the device being used to build tension, because what's happening during the episode is they're shooting it at magic hour and they have a limited time window to get this shot.
Of course.
So every time the shot messes up, we can actually see in real time the LA sun going down.
Like
we can see
crazy.
We can see the sky outside getting darker and darker as the episode goes, and it's just like, oh no, oh no, oh no, oh no. Like, and the DP keeps being like, we've maybe got one chance at, like, by the time they're like finally at their final chance at the thing, he's like, we have to go right now, but we maybe get one, like we have, you know. And it's just, but so you feel that ticking clock and you can literally see it, and it's cool because the fact that the camera doesn't cut, you're like, you're watching the sun go down as the episode goes on, and you're like, oh geez, oh no, they're gonna miss the shot, you know.
Totally.
I will say, I think you're right that this show is about what's happening to these people. Episode two or episode three is about what's happening to this therapist who has to sort of keep this this veneer of professionalism and this sort of emotional distance up, but we see that cracking as she's getting to know as she's getting to know this really troubled young man, and both kind of having a feeling of loathing him and also feeling a great well of sympathy for him and sadness for him, and juggling that. I will say episode two for me, while it's the most technically impressive, I think is the one where plot wise it loses me a little bit, because it does feel like, and I felt this a little bit in episode one too, where like I thought they were going to set up a four episode. I did think it was going to be a mystery show. What's interesting to me about the character of Jamie is he pretty much consistently denies having done this crime from the jump. He's telling his parents, I promise I didn't do it.
And so
you're kind of thinking in conventional terms of what would normally happen in a TV show like this is the cops are saying, we know your son committed this crime. He's saying, I promise I didn't do it. They're saying, we've got CCTV footage of it. And you're thinking there's probably going to be a twist where like one of his friends dressed up like him or something like that we're going to find out later on, or someone was using his phone to send text messages or something like that, because the kid is adamant that he did not do it.
Yeah.
And episode one does this rug pull where they just show us the footage, and it's pretty clear in the footage, like, that's the kid, that's Jamie, and he's committing this murder. Like, he's doing it. And his dad has an amazing performance where he realizes, like, and he just asked him, you have to promise me, son, did you do this? And I'm going to ask you one time. And he says, no, I didn't. And then he goes, okay, I believe you. And then they come in and show the dad this footage, and he's just devastated by it. But what's weird is, not only is Jamie still denying it when we catch back up with him in episode three, but episode two also does this weird thing where it continues to feel like they're trying to set up a mystery. Like there's a girl at school that they're interviewing, and she seems to be suggesting that Jamie didn't do it and that there was someone else involved. And she gets in a fight with a kid and she accuses that kid of doing it. And there's like a foot chase with that kid. And it kind of feels like the show is setting up like, ooh, there is maybe some kind of other element to this, but it's not. It's,
yeah.
And again, I think maybe what's actually going on is it's just showing that the show is more realistic. It's more just like, mm-hmm. there was a kind of accomplice. This is a friend who gave him the knife.
Right.
And that's why he wanted to, you know, but I think that this episode muddies the waters of the plot a little bit, just because it feels like they are trying to do a mystery fake out.
Yeah.
One too many times for me in this show, or even in episode 3, when he's still denying it with the therapist, I'm like, it still feels like this show is wanting me to believe that he did do this. And then they're going to do a late in the game, another rug pull and be like, but he didn't do it. But that's not what you know, do you feel that at all when you
watch
the
show?
Yeah.
I actually felt the exact same thing. Like, and I think there's a reason for that. So in episode 4, excuse me, I was thinking the same thing. Like, well, he says he's not doing it. And like, you see the footage, but you don't see the murder. They don't have the murder weapon. And so it does kind of make you think like, well, maybe he didn't. I mean, he's saying he didn't. Like, is this really something? And then in episode 4, even in episode 4, which this is 13 months later, there's a guy at the hardware store that's like, oh, I don't think your son did it. Like, I don't, you know, like, you know, and so like, they're still doing it. They're still making it seem like
people on message boards that are sort of doing like internet sleuthing, where they're like, we think we figured out these other like there's evidence that the police missed, because this is a thing that happens too, is internet detectives like to get on.
Yeah, they want to solve the murder.
Right.
Right. And so I think what they're doing, again, going back to kind of what I was talking about, like, this is very much about the emotions of the characters in the moments that they're in. And for episode 4, I feel like I learned this principle a long time ago, and I see this a lot in films and TV, whether it's intentional or not. You know, there's 5 stages of grief, and the 5 stages of grief is a great way to structure a show.
Yeah.
If you look at Groundhog Day, that's kind of how Groundhog Day is structured. He starts out with denial, and then he goes, you know, depression. And then at the end he gets to acceptance. And once he accepts it, that's when he moves on to the day. Right. So there's a really great way to structure shows. And I feel like this show is kind of structured or using that same model. And I feel like episode 4 is kind of like, in every episode, you're kind of denying like, well, you know, you bargain like, how did he do? Maybe he didn't do it. Like, maybe he didn't. And then you get frustrated. Like, well,
episode 3's got some anger for sure.
Oh, yeah. Totally. And so like, you have all these emotions, and acceptance is the hardest part, right? And so in episode 4, that's really just the acceptance episode. Like, they go through all the emotions, but I mean, in the end, it's like they just have to accept the fact, because the son, spoilers, which I don't think we said that at the top of the episode, but sorry, spoilers for the entire show. But
yeah,
you know, Jamie calls and the whole family's in the car, and he tells his dad, like, I'm going to change my plea to guilty. And it's kind of like, they just have to accept it. Like, you can't really hold on to any hope. Like, he did it. And so as a viewer, like, it is frustrating. Like, well, what is this? Why are they trying to tell us that, like, maybe he didn't do it. Like, maybe he didn't. Right. And we're trying to see all this. And then in the fourth episode,
it sort of just feels like a way to extend the plot so that they can do more things and keep us on the line.
Yeah.
Which feels a little bit manipulative, but also, I don't know.
I think it's totally valid. I think it's more telling the viewer that this is a struggle for anybody to accept this, that someone that they knew or they loved or they cared about actually murdered somebody else. Mm-hmm. Like that. I mean, I have no idea what that's like, but obviously you're going to go through a lot of emotions in your own head of like, how do I cope with this? You know, and in episode 4, the father's really not completely coped with it until the end. At least that's kind of what it's implying.
Well, but it's like, also really even interesting how thoroughly a person who's committed an act like this can commit to denial.
Yes.
Because you'd think that like when you'd think that if you're Jamie and you're just a young kid, like, and you're just caught and they've got you on camera.
Yeah.
And, they, you know, and it's like very clearly you. assaulting this girl, whether they've got you stabbing her or not, it's like, hey, we got you, kid.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, that you would just kind of go like, okay, all right. But the fact that he's so willing to, in the face of such strong evidence, commit to this denial. And I mean, this is like something that we've seen this before. You see this in true crime documentaries where people will just insist and insist and insist upon their innocence, even in cases where there's really strong evidence against them. And sometimes these cases remain kind of up in the air and they become the matter of debate amongst public opinion. People who watch these documentaries have their own fan theories on what happened, and maybe no one will ever know, but it's really interesting how a person can just decide, I'm just going to commit to this narrative that I, you know, that unless you can show me the actual footage of me actually doing it, I'm gonna commit to it. It was someone else. It wasn't me.
Yeah.
It wasn't me. And I think that I don't, you know.
I think it is an emotion. I think that that could very well have been on purpose, what they were trying to do. Right. Again, because it's kind of like this emotion, this emotional roller coaster is really, in real life, a really hard thing to cope with for everybody. Mm-hmm. And the police look at it from the facts. And that is the most, you know, she was murdered basically right at the time of when they have the footage of him doing it. Like, what are the chances of someone else doing it? You know, and it was with a knife that is, anyway. So they're very matter of fact, but the people involved with it, the parents, it's all about emotion, right?
Yeah.
And it's it bothered me, but I felt like that was on purpose. So it bothered me, but I felt like, oh, okay, well, it's contributing to the story. So I think that was intended, but it is kind of like the second episode for me, though, if I'm going to change gears a little bit.
Sure.
The second episode to me was the most straightforward with the theme of the entire show, which what I took away from this show, the theme of the entire show is fathers. This is a show about fathers.
Yeah.
First episode. The first episode, he gets arrested, but he needs an adult there, and he chooses his father over his mother. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're talking about it. I mean, you know, and then in the second episode, the story is really the cops, the main cop. It's about him, but it's about him and his son. That is ultimately the story that they're really telling. Because his son, it seemed like he might have been on the spectrum. Did you get that with his son?
For sure. But also whether his son's on the spectrum or not. I mean, like, his son's definitely like being put in a special class for kids who are. But also it seems like his son kind of just chooses a life where he's makes himself small and quiet because of the bullying that he receives.
Yes.
But then by the end of the episode, we get a scene with his son where he actually opens up and communicates. And he sounds quite. I don't want to use the word normal, but maybe neurotypical is the better word.
Yes.
Rather than neurodivergent, it seems like maybe this kid has just chosen to isolate himself. Because I would actually say that more so than, I think definitely fathers is a big thing, but I would say that the show, because this is the other thing, like the two big things that people talk about with this show are the technical convention of shooting every episode as a one-er, and the other big thing is that this is talking about men.
So
it's like not just fathers, but also what's going on with young men, what's happening with young men on the internet, what's happening with, you know, like in America we have a big problem with violence at schools, with mass shootings, and it's pretty much universally young men who are doing these things. And in many cases, in a lot of these mass shootings, it's like young white men, and it's sort of like, so what's going on the internet? What's you? And we obviously know about, they talk about the 80-20 rule in this show, and how these things that are sort of circulated in incel culture on the internet of 80% of women are only attracted to 20% of men, which means that 80% of men are left without a fighting chance in the dating pool. And that just and that these are these kind of stories that young men circulate on the internet that make them feel angry and disenfranchised.
Right.
And so yeah, it's absolutely about fathers trying to figure out how the fathers that were not raised in the same technological era as their kids were. So I was going to ask you about that too, because we are, I feel like as millennials, we're like part of a hinge generation where we got both.
Yeah.
We had analog technology, and we also remember our homes getting internet for the first time. We had dial-up internet with the very loud sound, and we knew what it was like to wait several hours to watch a 2-minute long video clip on the internet. And we were part of the transfer into full, you know. And so it's like a few years ago, I remember my sister asking me, like, what would you do? You have any recommendations? I don't about what to do with kids on the internet these days. And I was like, why are you asking me? I'm like, I'm not a parent. And what I say is it seems impossible. Like, I don't know how you protect your kids from the internet in the modern age. I just don't know if it's doable. But I wonder for you as a father, what kind of experience you had with this.
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and it's something that is very scary. I have an 11-year-old boy, a 9-year-old boy, and then I have my two daughters who are 7 and 5. So my oldest son is very much, and he kind of looks and acts in some ways like Jamie. Mm. So for me, when I was watching this, my wife, first of all, we first started watching, she's like, "I hate this. I can't watch this." And I'm like, "I don't blame you. Like, I totally get it." Like. And it was really hard for me. I had to separate myself to kind of like just whenever I thought of my son, I was like, no, I just got to keep thinking about the show. Mm-hmm. But it's hard. Like, as you said, we're a part of this hinge generation that has had both. And a lot of people are very worried about the internet and about social media. And it is something to be very scared of. We have to be very, very cautious of this. Now, like I said, my son is 11, so I haven't had a ton of experience. He doesn't have a phone. He has a watch that he can communicate with his friends. We gave, you know, an Apple Watch that has cellular on it. And me and my wife are talking about if we're going to get him a phone or not right now. But I think the most important thing, I mean, this is kind of the show itself is just talking about, like, just in general. I don't think it's taking a huge stance either way, or it's just kind of like presenting you with what's going on in this kid's life. Mm-hmm. It's obviously saying that there are a lot of dangers, but I think it's also saying, like, sometimes you just can't prevent it, right? Like,
I think that's a big thing, especially in episode 4, you know, because the big thing in episode 4 that was just heartbreaking for me to watch.
Oh, it was so hard.
I cried a lot in episode 4 of this show. I cried a lot at the end of the show.
Yeah.
That the scene with the mom and dad in their bedroom, and then him going into his son's bedroom just absolutely broke my heart.
Me too.
But when they're talking about how did we make that?
I
was reminded of, there was this documentary, I can't remember what it was called, or maybe it was an episode of it was a TED Talk.
Oh, okay.
Dylan Klebold, who was one of the Columbine shooters, his mom did a TED Talk.
Oh, wow.
And she talked about what it's like to be the mother of this person who, and how she has to square in her mind and in her heart, you know, what her role in her son's life was. And and the fact that she still says, like, I love my son, and I feel guilty for loving my son, and trying to explain what her experience has been like, and knowing that she's like, there are people who think that I'm a bad person,
right,
and I can't fault them for that, because I'm responsible in many ways for the upbringing of that kid. But also, you know, I mean, the thing that the show wrestles with is they also have this daughter who's a great person, and, you know, and I love the line where he goes, how did we make her? And and the what his wife says, the same way we made him.
Yeah.
And it's like, you can only do so much.
Yeah.
Because the thing about having kids is, like, they are individual, separate people.
They
are going to have the experience they're going to have. And there's only so much you can do as a parent to shape their well, psychology or, you know.
Yeah. And it's, yeah. And it really is amazing. Like you can only do, I have so many thoughts, I'm sorry, but the best thing that I feel like I can do for my son is to be there for him, mm-hmm. to have a good relationship with him where I can talk to him and that he feels free to talk to me. Now there's going to be times that I have to discipline him and I have to try and correct him if he's done something wrong. Mm-hmm. But I think the more important than monitoring his internet, you know, activity and his social media activity is involving him in my life and being there for him. I think that's the most important thing for me to do as a father, to show him what it means to be a good father. So to be the example, but then to be there to talk to him. Yeah. And I think, you know, you and I both had great father figures. Mm-hmm. We were very lucky to have that, which, but in the end, it comes down to, I mean, you and I both made dumb decisions, you know?
I still do.
Avoid it. Oh, yeah, we all still do. And it is not my father or my mother who did that. It's me. That's my fault.
Yeah.
Those are the dumb things that I did.
Yeah.
Like, you can, and this is kind of a weird analogy, but I always think about this, like sports, right? Sports, mm-hmm. Let's look at LeBron James. LeBron James is one of the best athletes, you know, he's one of the best basketball players.
Sure.
You know, all that. You look at, and for some reason, this happens with all athletes, we always think that their sons are going to be amazing athletes.
Right.
Like, oh, this kid's son is going to be amazing. Like, oh, let's get his son. He's going to be awesome. It's like, I finally had to tell myself, like, no, they're not. Just because their dad is an amazing athlete does not mean that they are going to be good. Now, we're looking at LeBron James. His son is good enough to make it in the NBA. Many people don't think he is good enough to be in the NBA, but he has made it to the NBA, right? Yeah. And he is nowhere near good for him for making the NBA. That's better than the vast majority of people.
He is not
as good as his dad.
I was actually just thinking about this today, about like how many players are in the NBA right now who are the sons of players we grew up watching, that there's so many juniors. There's so many, like Hardaway Jr. Gary Payton Jr. And that's obviously right. Steph Curry is the son of Del Curry, who was a very famous player in his own right. Yeah. But Steph Curry has far outpaced his father. Yeah. But you know, it is interesting because it's like, you could look at Bronny James and go, you know, oh, did he just not work hard enough? Bronny James, if we went and played a pickup game and Bronny James came and played, we would be amazed how good at basketball he is.
He's
like probably better at basketball than 95% of the people in the world.
But the
top 5% of people in the world all play in the NBA.
Yeah.
And he's in that group on the lower side of it.
Right.
You know, but yeah, it's like there is, I think that obviously, it's not to say that parenting plays no role whatsoever in what kind of outcome is, you know, but you can look at stuff like, you know, people will often talk about like the Hanks, Tom Hanks's sons, that there's Colin and Chet, and Colin and Chet couldn't be more different from each other.
Very different.
And I know like a very famous meme is like this: Colin Hanks and Chet Hanks are proof of like, that names are important, because if you name one of your sons Colin, you're going to get a Colin. And if you name one of your sons Chet, he's going to be a Chet. It's like, it's like Chet is so much more of a Chet than,
That's, you know, that's fine. Yeah. I mean, it just goes to show that like you are a product of your parents, but you are not everything that your parents are.
Yeah.
You are a completely individual person, and we as a society like to group people. Well, if his father's like that, he's like that.
Yeah.
If his brother's like that, he's like that. Mm-hmm. If his sister's like that, she's like that. You know, like it's just easy for us to do that. But when we look at that, like, I'm very similar to my brothers, but I am a different person than all my brothers. And same with you. And I am a different person than my father.
And well, in in so many ways, you and I had such similar upbringings.
Yes.
Like we always talk about on the show, we grew up right next door to each other.
Yeah.
We grew up in the same church, in the same faith structure. We grew up, we had a lot of the exact same male role models and leaders in our community.
Yep.
And one thing that I never thought in a million years I would be is an addict. I never thought in a million years I'd be an alcoholic and a drug addict. And the fact that like that happened in my adult life is so, it was so beyond my like scope of what I thought was possible for the way that we were raised and where we were raised. And it's just like, oh, it just, it, you know, and I see this all the time in recovery too, that it's like, it's no respecter of economics. It affects people who were raised on the very low end of the socioeconomic spectrum, and it affects people who were raised in a very affluent and wealthy circumstance too. And it's sort of like, it's more about the individual's experience. But I do think that this show is still trying to, I don't know that the show is trying to preach or I don't think it has a message of how to fix what's going on with young men. But I do think that the show seems concerned about about what's going on with, you know, like how and I so I think you are right that it comes back to this relationship fathers have with their sons and relationship parents have with their sons of like, is there something here that could have been done, or is it just something you have to just kind of go, I don't know, boys are scary.
I think the nice thing about this show is that they have a much more complex relationship because, you know, in a lesser show, I shouldn't say a lesser show, in some other shows, you know, you have somebody who's a murderer and then you show the parents and they're horrible. And it's like, oh, well, that's the reason. Like, that's, there it is. Like, the dad was abusive, which that does happen. That's, that's not saying that that's not real and that doesn't happen. That obviously happens. But this is taking, you know, this is showing something that's so much more complex because the father, even though he has a temper, and even though he probably wasn't a perfect father, like his son really, really loves him. And in the episodes that we see him, we see that he is genuinely trying to be a good father. Like he's genuinely trying to be a good person, you know? So it's like, I think it is saying it's very, these things are very concerning. Social media use and internet use is very, can be very concerning, but you can do everything, you know, the right way. And we still have our choices. No matter what, we have our agency. Like we can't blame anyone else but ourselves. And that's what, you know, ultimately, I don't know if it's really, it's not really screaming this in the show, but this was Jamie's choice. This was his, he's 13 years old. He can still make a choice.
Yeah.
And he chose to kill this girl. Like he chose to let his anger get the best of him. And his parents did everything they could. And it obviously didn't work out because they're not there controlling him. Like that's his own choice.
I think that another good thing about episode three too, though, it's important in episode three that this therapist character is a woman, because this is another big theme of this show is it's not just about what's going on with young men or the relationship between young men and fathers. That's obviously a big part of that's why we're even following the one detective and his son is we're trying to draw a parallel there, but we are also just talking about like, what are young men learning about how to relate to women and what, you know, what healthy relationships with women look like. I think about this all the time. Like I, as an adult, have always had platonic friendships with women. And I know this is not necessarily the norm, like because a lot of my friends like you and a lot of guys that I grew up with got married young and it's not normal for married young men to necessarily have like a lot of just female friends that they go and hang out with regularly and go get lunch with the girls, like but like I as a 37 year old man who's been single a lot in my adult life, I have a very large group of friends that are women, and I always kind of did though, like growing up I had a lot of cousins my age who were girls and so I learned how to be friends with girls without there having to be something attached to it, like some kind of chase. And again, like this is not, this is just like circumstance, this is just this is just, oh, I was lucky to be able to learn how to be friends with women, and also doing theater and doing, you know, like stuff like that. Like I just learned how to have platonic relationships with women where there didn't need to be some kind of element of, and I see this a lot as an adult. I meet a lot of adult men who have never really had the experience of having strong platonic friendships with women. It's always been like, if there is a woman that I spend significant time with, it's probably because there's something romantic going on. And so I wonder what your feelings about that are, you know, as a person who's been married your entire adult life, like, about what this show has to say about how men are and young men are being taught or conditioned or learning to relate to women.
Yeah, it's I think I also loved episode 3 because of that fact that you're talking about as well. It had so much into it. Like, there was so much subtext with the female character that wasn't really even touched on, but you could see what's going on because she keeps going out and talking with that one security guard who's not doing anything inappropriate, but you could tell he has some sort of attraction with her that she just has to like deal with. And she has to like, okay, I've got, you know, I just thought it was amazing how she acted in that situation and how that all played out. But yeah, it's like, it's hard because, and I think this is where I have less experience in some way, because it is, we grew up in a different time, but I think, you know, it comes down to a lot of it is your relationship with your parents, your mother and your father, and the relationship that they had. How did your father treat your mother? How was your mother? So for me growing up, I grew up with 5 brothers, and you know, everybody who, whenever we tell that, like, oh my goodness, your poor mother, you know, and it's always like, I always kind of feel bad. Cause I'm like, listen, my mom was amazing.
Yeah.
Like my mom was such a great mom for boys because
guys really didn't give her too much grief.
No, we never did. Yeah. Like we were, you know, when you think of 6 boys, you think, you know,
what it could have been.
Exactly. But my mom was great because she was a very strong woman. She was a great example of a woman for me and for my brothers. And so that was great. We had such a great example. And then my father treated my mother very, very well. You know, they still have a great relationship, which is a great example to me. So I think how you perceive women and how you perceive your relationships with women comes so much from your own experience, but also what you're seeing. And I think there is a lot of negative portrayals online that can be very harmful. I think a big thing for how you treat women is just being very self-aware of how you're treating women. Right. And I mean, take this with a grain of salt. I'm a white man. That's, you know, what do I know? But I've been lucky enough to be able to work with a lot of women in a professional setting. And, you know, it's been very helpful for me because, I mean, me and my wife have been married. It'll be 16 years this year. But, you know, and obviously you can get into inappropriate relationships if you're spending a lot of time with another woman. And I think it's very dangerous if you're doing that. You know, it can lead into very dangerous situations, obviously. And not to say that you can't have platonic relationships.
You'd have to be like Mike Pence about it, where he's like, I can't be alone with another woman who's not my wife.
And I think in a professional setting, it's nice because, I mean, you have to be professional. And so, but, you know, women are not less than. You know, women, and we are different. Men and women are very different. We complement each other. And it's hard for me because I grew up in a time that didn't have this. You know, we grew up in the 90s when we didn't have so much social media that has so many differing opinions. So it's interesting how they portray this in the show, because he does seem to have a very, very generic perception of who women are and how they should be. And I think that was done really, really well, because it can be very dangerous when you think of women as things, you know, or as less than.
You can see him struggling to sort of accept the personhood of this therapist.
Right.
He's so like skeptical of her. He's so like, right. He has such a hard time just kind of letting his guard down. He always thinks that she's trying to manipulate him in some way.
Yep.
Or, you know, and then he accuses her several times of, you know, like, oh, you got a boyfriend, do you? Like, he just has such a hard time relating to her as another person. And I also think that this is interesting too, that he picks his father in the first episode too, because I think that there's something about this, like, even though I think he loves his mother, but I think that this kid has a fundamentally really hard time knowing how to communicate with women. And I think that this, so I'm glad that the show doesn't try to answer the question, but I like that the show is asking the question of of like, how do we, I do a lot of obviously sociopolitical advocacy on my other channels and things like that.
Right.
I had this young activist ask me back in the fall, at an event that I was working for. He said, we're getting, this kid was like 22, and he's like, hey, so we're getting killed in my demographic. Like, kids my age are just increasingly getting more and more down the pipeline of like, of really misogynistic, you know, harmful stuff.
Yeah.
Like, do you have any ideas of what to do? And I was like, buddy, you're barking up the wrong tree. My audience is like 70% female. And I'm like, I don't, like, there's not a lot of men that that watch my stuff. And I know that there are, but I, you know, the shows like Jake and Logan Paul and guys like this, when you look at their audience demographic, it's like 90% men. It's more. A lot of these shows in like the manosphere of podcasting and what boys seem to gravitate toward and think is cool. And again, it's like guys talking to guys and guys talking to guys about what their speculations on women and all of this stuff. And again, I don't have the answer, and I'm glad that this show doesn't try to have the answer.
But I'm
glad that the question's being asked of like, we've got a problem at the core of our society, and it didn't start with the internet. It didn't just start with social media. And the problem is like, how do we get, as you said, women are not less than, obviously, how do we get men to finally just get to a point where they can communicate better with women without it having to be this like fraught thing that either has this overhang of fear of like, ooh, I don't want to get into anything that looks inappropriate or romantic, or has this sort of derogatory element where you know the woman makes you feel insecure because she has a power over you that you know like, and so you start being mean because you feel insecure. I think that a lot of these questions are brought up in this show, and I'm glad that they are, because I see it as a problem that is kind of as old as civilization itself, that we are continuing to grapple with, and that we're definitely not solving in the information era of the internet. Like, we continue to be sort of sequestered into our different pockets. Like, the reason why his sister is the way that she is because she's having a completely different experience with society than he is, you know? And they have the same parents, and they feel loved and accepted by their parents, but I don't know. It's interesting.
I know. Yeah. And it is good. This is what I like about this show too. Like you said, it just kind of raises the question. It's not trying to answer the question, because there is no answer. There is no universal answer to how do we fix this? If there was, it would be a whole lot easier to fix it. But everyone is their own person. Everyone is has their own individual choice and actions and what they can and can't do. And there's a lot of problems. It ultimately comes down to looking at looking at yourself and seeing what you need to do better.
Right? Yeah.
And a lot of people don't want to do that. And that's hard. I mean, it's hard for all of us in many, many different ways. We have to be accountable, and we have to make changes in ourselves to fix problems that are out there in the world. And it's really not to say that we can't fix a lot of people, But yeah, there's no one size fits all for, you know, the human race. So.
Right. Because like I said, it's like in my personal experience is that I've never had a hard time relating to women or having like,
yeah,
but I know that like, I don't have that as like a thing that I hold over other men, because I know that my experience was just different.
Yeah.
And then my experience in adulthood has just been like, oh, it just sort of naturally happened that way, that I just, through different channels of circumstance, found myself in a situation where a big portion of my platonic friends that are really close, a big portion of my closest friends are women. And the people that I call on the phone and talk with, people that I go have lunch with, people that I go get coffee with are women. And they're women who are in their own romantic partnerships. And we talk about, like, we have like girl talk and stuff. Like when I used to live in New York, I was in this big friend group, and all the girls in the friend group would often have like girls night. And I was the only one that was invited to girls night. And the guys, the guys in our friend group would be like, why is Austin invited to girls night? And they'd be like, cause he doesn't try to hook up with us at girl. And I was like, and it's weird. Like I was sort of treated as though I were like a gay guy in the friend
group. Right,
but
right.
Which everyone knew I wasn't, but I've always had that sort of ability to assimilate. And again, I don't look at that as like me being better than other men.
Right.
I view it as a matter of just like circumstance, that this always sort of came a little bit more naturally to me for whatever reason. And so it's not something that I can look at other men and go like, you should be like me, because I fail in all of these other ways.
Right.
There's all these other ways in which, like, frankly, the thing that I've struggled with in my life is romantic relationships with women. That's where I've struggled, is I've had lots of different partners and lots of different chapters that haven't worked out. And that's where I have a much easier time maintaining a friendship with a woman than I do maintaining a romantic relationship. And so again, it's just like, it's a question that I don't have the answer to, but I like when a show that is viewed by a lot of people and that is consumed in a big way. And maybe that's the answer for the oneer thing, is like the oneer is the gimmick. It's the hook that gets people watching.
Yeah.
And then they can Trojan horse in these important questions.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I mean, ultimately I feel like the oneer factor of this show works really, really well for the story that they're trying to tell.
Yeah.
This story could absolutely be told without oneers, but I like it because it focuses so much on the emotion of it. And it can touch on all these really important topics of parenting and relationships and men and women and all that, but it doesn't have to hit you over the head with it because it has to be so focused in. And that was actually another thing that I kind of wanted to talk about, is one of the reasons you want to do a oneer is you want to limit yourself. Creativity, it thrives.
I'm like
really,
showing
really
this
well.
Like sponsored label every time I drink this. I'm like, oh, I should not do. We are not sponsored by BetterHelp.
No, if you want to though, we'll get sponsored. But the thing about oneers and about creativity is like it when you do a oneer, you really have to figure out, like, it's a lot harder. It's a lot harder on you. You have constraints. And constraints are a very, very good thing for creativity, because it makes you figure out the problems. Like, oh, if they could have just cut and done all this other stuff, we could have had a similar show and maybe it would be just as good. But when you do a oneer, you think, okay, well, how do we get from A to B? Like, physically, how do we get from A to B? Like, it's a oneer. How do we do that? So they're constraining themselves to make the show more creative, to just give you a different perspective and make you think about things in a different way, you know, because when you cut back and forth again with Warfare, it was awesome. It was real time. Yeah. That's great. It works really well. That comes with its own constraints, you know, and this comes with its own constraints as well. And I think it's a great thing as a filmmaker, and it's a great thing as a creative person to give yourself constraints so that you don't have too many options. You can kind of go off the rails. Like it really focuses in on what story you're trying to tell. Mm-hmm. And I really like this show because it is really focused on a very specific story for each episode.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's a very well executed show. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about before we get into scores?
No, I don't think so. I think we
okay,
can
cool. Yeah, so we will do our scores now for Adolescence. You can stream this now on Netflix if you have a Netflix account. And let us know what you think. If this is your first time watching The Oner, which is our podcast, we do scores for technical rating. That's how well we feel like the movie or TV show we're talking about was technically executed at a craft level, cinematography, acting, music, all of that good stuff. Then we do a score for the ending. How well did this thing stick the landing? How good was the ending? We do a score for rewatchability. We do a score for cultural impact or relevance. And then we do a subjective score. So Kramer, for Adolescence, what's your technical rating?
My technical rating is a 9. I think that this obviously is a huge technical achievement. I mean, it took a lot to get this thing made. So that gives it high marks for me. But then on an acting level, like this had to have been extremely hard for the actors.
Yeah.
Like, and I think they all pulled it off. Like, I don't think there was really like anybody that stood out as a weak link in the acting. I think actually it showed that there's a few people that just really, really stood out. Like, you know, obviously the father, Jamie, and then the, she's not a social worker, but the woman in the third episode, what was she? Was she a
therapist?
She's an independent therapist. Yeah. Those three really stood out, and they were just amazing. But everybody else was really great too. The son of the cop and the cop himself were also really great. So
yeah, there's not a weak link in the cast. It's an incredibly well-acted show. That's what really stood out to me when I watched it is the writing and the acting. I gave the show a 9 as well. Technically, I feel like they executed the technical demands of the Oner for each episode very, very well.
Yes.
And if you've ever tried to do a Oner, I mean, that's even like 5 minutes long, you know how hard it can be, how many different things can go wrong to make you have to restart. And the fact that these were all true Oners is very technically impressive. The reason why I don't give it a 10 out of 10 is some of that stuff I mentioned earlier, where I just feel like there are sometimes little plot elements that are there to just keep me on the hook, to pull me through, that don't necessarily go anywhere, that are just sort of dead ends that are meant to keep me intrigued, when really what I'm watching for is just to watch the emotional journey of these different
characters.
And I wonder if some of that stuff could have been stronger if we just kept it even more grounded.
Yeah. I think even one thing that we didn't talk about, that as you're talking, I am reminded, the problem with Oners is it draws attention to itself.
Mm-hmm.
You when you realize it hasn't cut, then you start, okay, when is it going to cut? Oh, wow. This is crazy. This is still going on. Mm-hmm. And like, that's a good thing, but it's also in some ways takes you out of the story a little bit. And that is also kind of what this, like, sometimes I was like, oh, would that happen? Like, would this really happen in the sequence? Or like, okay, it's kind of drawing attention to itself a little bit. So it takes you just a little bit out of the story. More of a nitpick, not a big deal, but I think you're totally right.
How do you feel about the ending of Adolescence?
The ending, it's kind of crazy because, I mean, I guess the fourth episode is the ending.
Yeah.
I gave it an 8, and I just think like, oh man, should I give it higher? Because I think his name is Stephen Graham. The actor, he just did such an amazing job. This is the guy that, like, you see him in a lot of movies and then he gives a performance like this and it's just like, oh my gosh, like that guy is really, really good. And I
had no idea that he had that in him, because I've seen him in so many. He's kind of a character actor that shows up in different things, and I've never seen him really take center stage like this. And he really knocked this out of the park.
Totally.
I've seen a lot of criticism for this last episode because it feels, I think for a lot of people, it feels unsatisfying to not go back to Jamie and not have some kind of, I think what people are primed to expect is something that feels more procedural, that feels like we finalize the case. And it feels a little emotionally unsatisfying to just have Jamie call his parents on the phone and say, hey, I'm going to plead guilty, and that be the end of his story. I get that. I get that criticism. I gave this ending a 9 because I was watching this whole episode going, oh, what an interesting choice that they're choosing to end here. But I actually feel like at this point, we need to actually be here. And yeah. I like that it comes full circle. I like that we end in his room, which is very, it's kind of where we began.
Yeah.
There's some really interesting technical Easter eggs. I don't know if you saw this on the internet. People talked about this that I thought was really cool. In the first episode, when Jamie's getting arrested, he rips the wallpaper on his bedroom wall. And it kind of creates like a V shape that almost looks like a knife. And then in the last episode, his dad is on his bed hugging his pillow, and it looks like the knife's going into his back.
Oh, wow. And
so there's some really interesting, again, technical execution stuff. When you think about if that was intentional, that they wanted to create a picture, that's pretty amazing forethought and blocking to into something like this.
Pretty
that's
amazing.
All. Yeah. And, but also I think that, you know, the people whose lives are going to, the show is about the ripple effect of what this kid has done to the community, to his family. So I think we need to land on this family and see how they're going to move forward and try to find some semblance of normalcy. And I think that it's a really strong emotional place to land. It is heavy and it doesn't leave you feeling great, but I think this performance really kind of does what it needs to do. I gave it a 9.
I think I got to up my score. Like, just in talking to it, I don't know why I haven't given a 9. So give it a 9 as well.
Yeah, and then rewatchability.
Rewatchability. This is a little bit lower for me. I gave it a 6 because it's a really, really heavy show. Really hard to really hard to watch. Extremely good performances. I definitely could watch it again. But it's heavy, so I just gave it a 6.
You and I are in the exact same spot. I was at a 6 just for the exact same reason, where I was like, excellent show. I would recommend it to someone who's never seen it, especially if someone was dealing with something, maybe with like a kid who goes through something like this. But I don't know that it's a kind of thing that I'm going to want to return to. Maybe, as an example, if I'm making something in the future that is a one or that wants to accomplish a maneuver that they do in this show, I could use it as an example.
Of
something that where it's worked. But I don't know that I would want to go through the journey of it again.
Mm-hmm.
I think there could be interesting things to look at just from a technical standpoint.
Oh yeah, totally.
Cultural impact and significance.
Yeah, I gave it a 7. I think it's hit the, a lot of people are talking about this. It is a limited series, so I kind of hope they don't do anything else. Just for the sake of the story. I mean, they could, but
they probably won't. Usually, they're pretty good about. Yeah. Beginning, middle, and end, and calling it quits. You know?
Which I think is good. I think this is where the story should end. So I think the problem with it, though, as far as the cultural impact, is that this will always be associated with a one-er, and should they have done it that way. But I still think it's having an impact, and I think it will continue to have an impact.
It's certainly one of the most talked about TV shows so far of this year. Mm-hmm. And I'm right with you. I'm at 7 because I don't know if it will continue to have, ramifications in years to come, but it's definitely going to be something that continues to prove the formula that I like anything that continues to prove the formula that you don't need to cut so much. The people. It actually keeps the audience on the wire when you don't. And, and so I like kind of seeing people get more and more ambitious with this.
Totally.
And then subjective score.
My subjective score is an 8. I think technically it's amazing. The acting, the fact that they were able to make oneers is great. I think some of the things that we talked about, it kind of takes you out of the story a little bit. Some of the things are, as we had said, I think this was a great show though. I mean, I think 8 is, it's a really, really well-made show that has a really good message that is executed very well.
Yep. I put it at 8.5. I really enjoyed the show. I just like watching good acting.
Yeah.
And this is a feast of good acting. And I enjoyed the technical execution of what they had to do. And I thought that it wasn't like distracting in a bad way. And I didn't find it to be something that felt just like a gimmick for the sake of a gimmick. I felt like it worked. I'm sort of a believer that oneers could be used way more often in everything. And I kind of believe if there's not a reason for us to cut, why are we cutting? If there's not, if you're not trying to say something with the cut, if you're not trying to do something with the camera and say something visually, then why are you cutting? If the scene is not over and we're, And we're not doing a time jump or something like that. I'm a big believer in, and I think stuff like this shows that, like, yeah, and stuff like The Studio, which I'm enjoying right now. The Studio, it's not just that one episode. Every episode has big, long sequences.
Yeah, yeah.
That are 3, 4, 5 minutes long where the camera doesn't cut. And I love that stuff. So
nice.
I really enjoyed this show. I don't, you know, know if I'll be visiting it again anytime soon, but.
Yeah,
8.5 from me. And good. What did you think out there in the audience? Did you enjoy the show? Did you find it to be too gimmicky? Did you find it to be manipulative? What do you think about the conversation here? Let us know. And if you want to follow along next week, we got to do it. We're going to be watching Thunderbolts.
It's going to be a good one.
They got a new Marvel.
It's going to be crazy.
I heard there's a new Marvel. You know that line?
That's what I was referencing. Yeah. What is it, friendship? Yeah.
It's going to be crazy. Yeah.
We should go see that. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to go see the new Marvel.
Yeah.
Thunderbolts. And we'll be talking about it next week. Go see it if you want to follow along.
Yeah. I got to say, though, why are you wearing a Mickey Mouse shirt?
Okay. This was my thought, is adolescence.
That's kind of what I thought. Yeah.
Adolescence. You know, like, I could have worn this for Andor.
Yeah. But, yeah. You could have.
But I didn't.
Mouse, yeah.
But this is, I think this is like, this is innocence and adolescence.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
you know?
Whatever. Yeah. Have you heard my Mickey Mouse impression?
No.
Okay.
Oh boy. What a great shirt. That's actually really good.
Oh, thank you.
This is reminding me of the episode where we did our Joker laughs and you blew mine out of the water. And you did like the best, you did such a good Joker laugh. So that's crazy.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Mickey Mouse is one that I can do very well.
Why don't you get into voice acting?
I could. This is the thing about voice acting. It is acting.
Yeah.
I don't know how my acting skills are.
Well,
it is hard, but hey, anybody listens to that wants me to be the next Mickey Mouse, I'll do it. But
that was pretty darn good, I gotta say.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Right. Yeah. We went to Disneyland and I was in the ride for the Mickey Mouse and I did it. And someone's like, wow, that was really good. So thank you, person. Anyway.
Yeah.
All right. Ended on that one.
All right, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Have a good one.